Welcome to the Water Resources Podcast. I am Bridget Scanlon. In this podcast, we discuss water challenges with leading experts, including topics on extreme climate events, overexploitation, and potential solutions towards more sustainable management. I would like to welcome Aaron Wolf to the podcast. Aaron is a professor of geography in the College of Earth, Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University. His research focuses on issues relating to transboundary water resources that are linked to political conflict and cooperation. And his training is really highly appropriate for this because he combines environmental science background with dispute resolution theory and practice. Aaron has worked with many different international agencies on water conflict issues, including the United Nations, the World Bank, food and agricultural organizations, and many others. And he has published numerous papers and books, including his most recent on the spirit of dialogue, which was published in 2017. Also, hydropolitics along the Jordan River, and contributed to others, such as the United Nations Transboundary Freshwater Dispute Resolution. So, Aaron, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you, Bridget.
So we chatted briefly before about the different potential topics, and I think on everybody's mind these days is the war in Ukraine and the Kakhovka hydroelectric power plant depleting 70% of the resource and flooding large areas of land. And also the Israeli-Gaza war, where Gaza traditionally relied on the coastal aquifer supplying 90% of their water, but now reduced to about 5% of what they have traditionally had access to, and then destroying both some access to desalinated water and destroying sewage treatment. So all of those issues are front and center. So maybe you would like to comment on some of those, Aaron.
Oh, sure. Yeah, thanks. I think what you touch on is a really important point about water. A couple of points. One is that it ignores boundaries. So people who often have enmities, whether it's as you mentioned, Russia and Ukraine or Israel and Gaza, India and Pakistan, Azeris and Armenians, that they often share water resources. And so one of the charges of hydropolitics is to help people manage their water resources even over tense borders. But the other point that you note is that water is often a victim of war. And it's certainly in the conflicts going on today, whether it's, again, Ukraine or Gaza or Syria or Sudan, that when people are engaged in battle or violent conflict, that it's very hard to get water to people. That just then exacerbates the destruction, often primarily to civilians. And I think that's what we're seeing worldwide today.
Right. And I guess the Israeli-Gaza conflict and the issues of wastewater treatment. So when they lose power, which they did shortly after the beginning of the war, then they lose their ability to treat wastewater and other things. So that linkage between water and energy too maybe gets amplified during war. So lots of issues there. So this year, March 22nd, is the United Nations World Water Day, and the theme this year was Water for Peace. And they emphasized online and in many other fora, the transboundary waters account for 60% of the world's freshwater resources and impacts that about 150 countries have territory within at least one of the 310 transboundary river and lake basins that you have worked a lot on to catalog and inventory, and then also overlap with maybe more than one of the 468 transboundary aquifer systems that the International Groundwater Resources Assessment, IGRAC, has maps of. So how successful do you think the theme was, or are people getting to understand these issues more and consider maybe water could be used more to create peace or those sorts of things?
Sure. So I think that we've gone through a couple of shifts in thinking, as it really is about half the land surface of the earth is covered in basins that are shared by two or more countries. And so as we discussed, when countries are in conflict, it's very difficult to manage their water effectively or efficiently. But the converse is also true, that the fact that they share water often gives entree to dialogue, a vehicle for dialogue, something to talk about that's so critical to all aspects of a country's economy, culture, religion, that it often will induce people to talk, even if they won't talk about something else. And so when I first got involved in the 90s, people were really focusing on this idea of water wars, all the numbers that you described, the resources that we share between tense countries would invariably lead to what was described as the wars of the 21st century would be about water. Water is the new oil. And so I think there was a lot of that thinking. And then I and a number of other people actually started to count things, count how many times we actually fight over water versus how many times we dialogue over water, how many treaties there are versus how many wars. And it turns out that our record is actually much, much richer on the dialogue side, on the peace building side. Two-thirds of the time we do anything over shared water, it's cooperate. And these are precisely the people that were predicted to go to war. It's Israelis and Arabs and Indians and Pakistanis. And so I think slowly we've been kind of shifting the ship so that people now recognize the peace-building components of water. And a lot of people now are kind of helping to refine that thinking also, that there's a group, the School of London. This is Mark Zaitoun and Nahum Muromachi. Well, they'll point out that that's true, but not all cooperation is necessarily good. Sometimes treaties solidify power imbalances, and not all conflict is bad. Sometimes if there are very inequitable or unjust situations, that it requires a certain amount of discord to recalibrate.
Right. So it's certainly not a black and white situation, and it's much more nuanced and so can have a lot of different impacts. And I commend you, Aaron, for developing a database of these treaties. And I think you have maybe about 400 water-related treaties now and have these data available online and everything. And so that's a huge help to understand how many of these transboundary systems have treaties. And it's I guess it's amazing how few there are really in the scheme of things, or how many basins they cover, or maybe you could describe when you started to collate these data and how you have developed it over time.
Well, as you mentioned in your kind introduction, Bridget, I started as a scientist. And so when I started to get familiar with the literature on the water wars, they were making huge prognoses and projections based on no data whatsoever. And so all I wanted was a lead sentence for an article that said there are X number of international basins. Nobody knew what X was. So that led to 3 years of pulling out World War II topo sheets and digitizing them and figuring out. So the first number, we did the first update, just how many basins there were. At the time, I think we said 214. Now we're up to 313. So we keep finding, or borders keep shifting. And so it was a simple, let's find out what's actually going on. And then the second, as you mentioned, all the treaties, we're actually now up to about 800 treaties. So similarly, in international law, generally they focus on the theories. So there's a theory of you can't cause another country significant harm. Another theory says you can only use what's reasonable and equitable. And I thought, okay, that's nice in theory. What are people actually doing in practice? So I went to find the book of water treaties, and it didn't exist. So again, it was just simply wanting to know what people actually do. So we started to Xerox, and we started to compile, and we started to pull, and then finally digitize and code them, so that now when somebody wants to know, how do we deal with in-stream flows? How do we deal with waste crossing an international boundary? Within seconds, they can scan all the world's treaties and find out how other people have done it.
Right. And it's great to have these data. And of course, if something isn't available online now, it may as well not exist, because exactly, we're not certainly going to go to find paper copies of anything hardly. It has to be readily accessible. And I guess with all of these treaties, then you sort of suggest that maybe some of these are like apple pie, they're just kind of like generalities maybe or something. How much enforcement power is there behind some of these treaties, and are they being tested in different regions? Do you think they stand the test and work?
Yeah. So the some of the treaties are quite general, as you point out. A lot of them are very, very specific. And what's impressive about them is they do tend to stand the test of time through decolonialization, through shifting governments, people do tend to honor their commitments, even if they're fighting over other issues. The classic case is the Indus Basin Treaty between India and Pakistan. This was signed in 1960. They fought four wars in that time between then and now. And every now and again, some politician will say, we're going to withdraw from the treaty, and they just don't. And anytime there's a dispute in the treaty, they actually follow the conflict resolution mechanisms to the letter. And so I think that's one of the impressive points about them. And the other is, again, I think because there are now so many and so accessible, it increasing I think the rate of people willing to sign on to treaties is also increasing.
Wow, that's great. And I was very impressed with one of your recent papers, Aaron, that you were looking at the impact of the Taliban returning to Afghanistan and what its effect would be on water management. And you were talking about the transboundary Helmand River. I would really like to, if you could describe the results of this analysis and how you felt the role of religion would play in this region. And I guess another example was the building of a large canal there, the Kosh-Tepe Canal or something, that would divert 20% of water from Amu Darya and keep it in Afghanistan. Maybe you can describe those a little bit.
Sure. So I think there are a couple of points that come up in that basin, the Helmand that you mentioned, and it's also true in quite a number of basins. I think we in the West have kind of shied away from, or learned to shy away from, speaking about religion and its influence in policy and decision making. This is kind of a post-Enlightenment ethic that we in the West have just kind of gotten accustomed to, is that the rationality and spirituality live in very, very different worlds. And you can have your spiritual life, but it's private in your Friday, your Saturday, your Sunday community, and it shouldn't influence policy. Well, that's a very recent phenomenon in a very specific geography. And the rest of the world, they don't make that distinction. And so you're talking regularly, very comfortable talking about religion's influence in your life and in political decision making. And one of the interesting things often is that faith traditions are shared across boundaries. And that's true in the Helmand. So the idea that both sides are Muslim, and that these are ethics that can be referred to as a commonality. The idea that you don't charge for water, that water is a human right, that water, you should never deny somebody else water. These are all articles of faith in Islam. And so the idea that the Taliban and the government of Iran subscribe to this is an entry place to dialogue. But this is true in lots of places. All of Latin America is Catholic, and the even different faiths. The Jordan River has brought together people of faith in Islam, in Judaism, in Christianity, to tap into the holy nature of the river in an effort to induce dialogue and keep it cleaner. So this is one of the points that I think comes up in that part of the world. And the other, you mentioned the Kosh-Tepe Canal, which has a lot of people downstream in the Amu Darya concern, because the plans for the canal predate the Taliban, and they've decided to dust it off and trying to get the investment funds to build this thing. And it could be huge for Afghanistan. Quite a lot of irrigation water would be available. But downstream countries are concerned already. I mean, there's a vast environmental degradation in the Aral Sea, and the countries of Central Asia are very concerned even without this. So that's the other thing I think the example brings up, is how often upstream developments are the trigger for downstream concerns and conflict.
Right. And I guess you are correct that we don't mention our religion. We hardly mention our politics. We just want to be robotic in some of those aspects. And it's getting even more so that way. But I mean, here you're seeing the value of going back to religion and how that can help guide policies and stuff and in a good way, because their religion emphasizes the importance of water. And I think maybe similarly in Aboriginal people in Australia or the tribes here in the US, the spiritual nature of water and acknowledging and recognizing that, it could maybe help us manage it a little bit more equitably or reasonably. So there are a lot of examples of conflict related to water, or maybe it's not conflict per se, but the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam that's being built in Ethiopia and potential impacts on irrigation in Egypt, which has traditionally relied on the Nile. I've also been reading about the Euphrates Tigris and the lack of any formal agreement between the countries there, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran. You mentioned the Indus agreement, but also there's the Ganges water dispute between India and Bangladesh and the 1996 treaty. And lastly, Mekong River concern about the Chinese building a lot of hydropower, maybe Laos building hydropower upstream, and this issue of upstream downstream, which seems to be prevalent in many of these regions. Maybe you could describe some of those, Aaron, and what your thoughts are.
Sure. So I think that the common thread in each of those examples, Bridget, is somebody upstream builds something or wants to build something, and there's no agreement in place with the downstream neighbors on how to deal with the impacts of the project. So a lot of people have been interested over the years in kind of indicators of water tensions, and they look to things like drought or climate change or development or water quality, and these tend not to be indicators. What you put your finger on is precisely the indicator. It's when somebody upstream wants to build something and is not consulted with their downstream neighbor, and then the downstream country will object. And that's true in all of these cases. So this is Ethiopia's upstream building this huge dam, has downstream Egypt concerned. Turkey's building dams, Iraq is concerned. Ganges had a diversion that got Bangladesh concerned. And China's building dams that has, you know, all the downstream countries in South and Southeast Asia concerned. So this really is the place to focus if we want to do things better. You have better conversations around development earlier, right? You don't wait till the thing's in place. And so what we try and do, we try to do some early warning monitoring. And so what we try and do is keep tabs on who wants to build things, who wants to build big things. And fortunately, if somebody has the money in hand, they'll put a tender out on the web to try and get engineering companies to bid. And so it's pretty easy to track when somebody wants to build something. And then we have our record of all the treaties. And so it's pretty easy to see if there's an agreement in place on whether they've made an agreement on this project or not. Oh, and so this is where we are. The positive point, I think, again, is that when upstream and downstream neighbors are willing to talk about upstream development, they'll notice a couple of things. One, along a river, it often does make sense to build the hydropower project for as far upstream as you can. Less environmental degradation, less impact on transportation, and the topography often is better suited for it. And the other thing is, if they do it cooperatively, both sides really can benefit, right? So storage upstream often can reduce flooding downstream, or can extend the growing season, or can extend the navigation season. So having the conversations feels like there are natural inducements to both sides. And then, of course, the downstream country may be interested enough maybe to buy storage upstream or to help jointly own the project. And so these relations between upstream and downstream are ones that really can be finessed, and there's a rich history of it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, oftentimes we just focus on the negative. And that's all. If it's anything good, we just don't talk about it. And I guess you're describing some of the situations where there's a win-win between upstream and downstream. And the hydropower that's generated could provide energy for downstream users and reduce flooding, as you mentioned, and other things. But the way we portray things, it's always doom and oftentimes doom and gloom, and don't talk about the holistic picture and the comprehensive assessment. So it's nice if people can describe that. And with more and more data being more readily available now, I think it helps with data access. But I mean, I think when I was reading about the Mekong River Commission created and stuff, but concerns that China was not sharing data on the reservoirs and operations and things like that. So data access and knowledge and commissions where the countries can talk together, I think could advance things a lot. I think other examples that I was reading in some of your work or others is just at a more local scale would be in parts of Africa where the pastoralists or the herders are in conflict with the settled farming communities, particularly during drought. And one example I read was about Kenya and about almost 300 people killed in that. And other examples in inner Niger Delta or in Mali and also cases in Ethiopia. Have you been involved in many of those, or have you had sort of analysis, herders?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Fortunately, we partner a lot with our colleagues at IHE Delft in the Netherlands, and they've really been focusing on this scale, on the subnational scale. And they've developed quite a nifty early warning system that do take into account the things that aren't indicators at the international scale. So as you point out, things like drought really do drive herders to clash with each other. And so the thing I think we're seeing is that as we drop in scale, the likelihood and intensity of violence over water goes up. That people won't necessarily cross a border to be violent with each other without quite a lot of impetus. But at the subnational level, as you point out, it's very easy to get states on the Narmada River in India. There are two states that have been tense and have broken out in violence over the years. And then here in the Western U.S., we've had quite a lot of farmer-to-farmer, farmer-to-environmentalist, or small-scale violence here as well. And so we'll work. I think the tools that we use, how to listen better, how to identify shared values, the tools that we use in dialogue are the same whether you're talking about international riparians or ranchers and environmentalists and tribes. So the conversations we've worked, we have a program in water conflict management here at Oregon State University, and we've worked with Bureau of Reclamation. We did 5 years of capacity building there to just help everybody develop skills in conflict transformation. We worked with Interior. They're adjudicating all their agreements with tribes in the West, and we worked with them similarly on different approaches, different worldviews around water. So I think you're right. I think as we drop in scale, tensions can go up, but we also have quite a lot of history of tools and experience in dialogue, even between stakeholders that don't see eye to eye, and across the political spectrum as well.
Yeah, I mean, some of these, I would assume that your conflict resolution training can help in everyday life. I mean, and especially these days, trying to de-escalate to things when people get pretty uptight about stuff. So I did enjoy listening to Chris Voss's book on Don't Split the Difference, which is, he was always negotiating with international, he worked for the CIA and stuff, and it's fascinating. So you've written many books and papers and stuff, and one of the ones that I was interested in hearing about was the hydropolitics along the Jordan River. I think that is possibly a nice example of solar energy generated by Jordan and transmitted to Israel, and then Israel returning with desalinated seawater. Maybe you can describe that. And I guess what you were looking at originally in the book, maybe you can give more background.
Sure. So this was based on the PhD that I did at the University of Wisconsin that was basically asking what are the impacts of of water on the Arab-Israeli conflict, but then what are the opportunities for water to help induce dialogue between Arabs and Israelis? And this was the mid-1990s. And it was interesting because I was dissuaded at the time. I said, don't even bother because there's never going to be peace talks between. And then sure enough, as I was writing my conclusions, they actually started the Oslo Accords. And so I had to keep rewriting my conclusions and actually got engaged as a consultant to the State Department because they looked around and said, who in the U.S. knows about the relationship between water and politics? And there weren't that many at the time. So I got to be engaged as the talks were starting. But there too, I think we've gone through some real shifts. So there were wonderful periods, the mid-1990s, where everything was possible. Peace was breaking out, not just there, but everywhere. Apartheid was over and the walls were coming down, and it was just a remarkable time of optimism. And what happens as soon as borders open up to cooperation is the possibilities for creative solutions also open up. So even within water, Jordan's running out of water and Israel is on the coast, Israel can desalinate and then reallocate the upstream flows of the Jordan or the Yarmouk River to Jordan. And so these kinds of trades suddenly become possible. And then, as you point out, that's evolved to move beyond water. That if you had the UAE was interested in investing and there would be solar power generated in Jordan, which would help fund desalination in Israel, which would provide water for Israel, Palestinians, and Jordan. So with peace, the possibilities are remarkable. And so there's a group called EcoPeace, and they have offices in Palestine, Israel, and Jordan all. And they were really working on this. They called the blue-green peace is that project. And then unfortunately, the attacks of October 7th and the subsequent war, all of these projects are now deeply on hold. And I think for the next little while, as soon as there is finally a ceasefire, the emphasis will be on rebuilding. And of course, water infrastructure will have to be an integral part because this period of conflict reminds us of how integrated we are also in times of discord. So as you pointed out, Palestinians now don't have the capacity to treat their sewage, which is just going into the Mediterranean, which because of the currents end up in Israel, clogging Israeli desalination plants. So that region is integrally connected for good or in times of conflict.
Right. And I guess building on the UN this year on their World Water Day and peace, there's a lot of emphasis in institutes and other groups working on water for peace. I think Stockholm International Water Institute has a peace research institute and water conflict working with the Pacific Institute in California and others. I did take the quiz and because I had read some of your papers, then I did better than anticipated. But some of those questions, it's difficult for us to understand. So that's a nice example where there could be cooperation, Israel and Jordan. And are there other examples? And you mentioned the Indus Commission between India and Pakistan, even though they have been subjected to several wars over that time, the treaty has held and they have abided by it. Are there other examples that you would like to mention or?
I think anywhere you find conflict and shared waters, you'll find whenever there's a possibility, the pool of shared waters will prevail. And so it's the examples that you gave. It's any of the big rivers have countries that don't like each other very much on them. And somehow they're all at various levels of negotiations or of treaties. Tigris, Euphrates, people focus on Turkey's building dams and downstream countries are concerned, which is true. But what you won't read about in the press is Turkish delegations traveling to Iraq and vice versa, that people really are talking about these. And even Azerbaijan and Armenia, they just fought a war within the last 6 months. And they too, whenever they can, even unofficially, will continue to dialogue and try and figure out how to resolve their water quality issues. The five countries of Central Asia, it's the same thing. I think anywhere you look, whenever there's even the smallest crack of opportunity, people will try and have dialogue around water, even when they won't talk about anything else.
Right. And that's very hopeful. And you mentioned walls breaking down and stuff in the 90s being a period of optimism. I guess that's another thing that can alter the picture is when USSR, you have a lot of other countries coming into play now. So things can change and then they need to develop new approaches to manage the system. So upstream, downstream, or Sudan, North and South Sudan, and things like that, countries splitting apart, then it can create challenges also, I guess. You wrote one of your early books is Transboundary Freshwater Dispute Resolution, and I guess developed some tools to resolve disputes and stuff like that. And I'm sure you've been building on that since you published it over time. Would you like to comment on this and what you've learned over time on these tools and stuff, how to advance resolution?
Oh, sure. Thank you for the opportunity. So I think two books bookend kind of my thinking on it. The one that you mentioned, which I wrote with a good friend and colleague, Jerry Deli Priscilli, who was at the Corps of Engineers at the time, kind of lays out, I think if we're thinking about water conflict resolution, the temptation in the West is to think it's all a technical issue. All you have to do is figure out the benefits of cooperation, optimize. And I used to think that. I started my career as a groundwater flow modeler. I was working for the U.S. Geological Survey, and there'd be a room full of angry people. And I'd say, hey, people, don't be angry. I've figured out what the answer is. And of course, it just made them angrier. And so that's what sent me back to try and understand something about the process of conflict resolution and how these conversations can be structured in a way that's more productive. But then that too, the way I was trained was also a very Western kind of rational approach to conflict resolution that focused on benefits. And then when I got in the room, it was, I don't know how else to describe it. It really was about the energy in the room, how people are sitting. If they're facing each other, it feels tenser. If they're sitting side by side, it can be calmer. How they listen, what their mannerisms are they listening with an open heart? Are they listening in a cold, calculated way? And so it turns out that those kind of skills also are taught quite regularly, but not in Western universities. And so this kind of sent me off on a multi-decade quest to learn from faith traditions and from indigenous peoples and how within different communities, how do they structure or understand conflict or anger? And what are the tools that they use for calming and for dialogue and within those communities? And so that's how I've kind of moved along the spectrum from the Western rational approach to now some kind of a synthesis between, yes, we need the science, we need the models, we need to understand what's there, and we need to understand empathy and honor and the importance of history and one's faith to be able to bring all of these aspects of incentives into a room to have the kinds of conversations we need. And fortunately, water touches on all of these aspects. And so it's once we acknowledge it and name it, it becomes quite easy to engage in a more holistic dialogue.
But so you must be aware then when you're in meetings and stuff, how clueless many of us are. We can't read body language. We barge on with our technical stuff and regardless of the feedback we should be receiving. I mean, it can probably be quite comical for you to, because thinking of where you've come from and how you have learned a lot of these things. I mean, we're looking at the Colorado at the moment, and there's going to be a lot of issues between rural irrigated agriculture and urban demands like Phoenix and Tucson and stuff like that. So it may not be really a technical thing. It may be more socioeconomic issue than a technical thing. And how are they going to manage those resources and stuff and distribute them? So I think we're coming along on this path to recognizing these are not just technical issues that we can run a model and get a number, but we need to consider the other effects and stuff and try to come to some sort of resolution. So I was visiting University of Alabama recently and the Global Water Security Institute, and they mentioned that you are working with them on forecasting water conflict. And maybe you can describe the data that you're using to forecast potential water conflicts in the future.
Sure. It's a lovely group, and I really enjoy working with them. I taught at the University of Alabama for 5 years, so I always am very comfortable anyway going back. But I'm delighted that DOD is investing in this direction, because I think they're recognizing too, especially with climate change, that all of our concepts about our relationship to conflict and to natural resources are going to be exacerbated for all kinds of reasons. And so I'm really delighted that they're looking forward, and the team there is really quite delightful. So as I mentioned, I mean, from my experience, most early warning can be done by looking at where people are planning to build dams and whether there's an agreement in place. And what they bring to the table is access to AI, to all kinds of assessments of things that didn't exist when I got started. They can look at who's tweeting what to whom, and just kind of this what's happening on the ground. What are people talking about? If they're talking about water at all in different communities, how are they talking about it? And so bring in this very, first of all, real time, but also much, much broader assessment of conversations at different scales, I think we'll have the first opportunity really to think in much more detail about decision making on the ground and how kind of citizens broadly are inputting into those decisions, but also the relationship between the two scales, the international scale that I'm kind of used to looking at, but also the relationship between that and the subnational scale, because the two influence each other, right? People on the ground won't do more than their governments allow them to do at the international scale, but at the local scale, they can push their governments in certain directions. And so that's what we're very hopeful, is kind of bringing the big kind of satellite scanning for tenders or scanning for dams, along with looking at tweets and what AI and whatever else we can find on the internet, and see if we can't sharpen our assessment techniques.
It's interesting when you mentioned that you spent 5 years at the University of Alabama, because that was my entree to the U.S. because Phil Lamoureux brought me to this country, and I did my master's in Tuscaloosa. So that's pretty cool. And I agree. I mean, it's one thing to have the technical data and stuff like that, but being able to access tweets and all these other things, newspaper articles, unsupervised machine learning, and make sense, incorporate that soft information into where they might move forward and how they might move forward, where their heads are. Artificial intelligence and machine learning approaches now are really opening up a lot of data that we couldn't really synthesize or harmonize in an easy way before. So, and this can feed into decision making and policy and stuff. So I think this is great. And Kate Brauman and others there, with so many data analysts on their team, I think this will be a huge resource and should help a lot. So we've talked a lot about how things have been evolving and the current status and stuff. What are you optimistic about the future in terms of transboundary water issues and how they might be able to help with conflict resolution or create peaceful solutions, or how water can be used as a to generate peace in different regions?
Yeah, I go back and forth, to be honest with you, Bridget. I, by nature, I'm an optimist. I've been involved in a lot of discussions where people who had really good reason to dislike or suspect each other would end up having a healthy conversation that resulted in some kind of tangible benefits for both sides. So that always gives one faith. And even here within the U.S., I'm involved with a small basin here, the Chewakan Basin and Lake Ebert here in South Central Oregon, where, you know, it's a drought on a lake, dried up a lake that the Pacific Flyway, the birds rely on, and initially it started to transpire like they do here in the U.S. is a group of environmentalists went to the state legislature and said, lake dried up, it's probably the rancher's fault, you got to start, you have to start enforcing the law. And then the ranchers organized, and then interestingly, instead of organizing and lawyering up and going to court, they kind of reached out and said, can we talk? I mean, if we understand each other and we have conversations, maybe instead of spending 10 or 20 years in court and having a decision enforced, we can come up with some creative solutions ourselves. And so this has now been going on. They've crafted a joint committee. They've just developed a joint fact-finding text. Where they were able to collectively tell the story of the basin. And so you do enough of that and you feel really good about the future. You're convinced. I'm often convinced that all of the yuck is just online. I almost nobody ever says to me the stuff that people say to me online. I mean, in person, people are delightful. People are lovely. People are genuine, generous and kind and empathetic. But then I don't know. At the macro scale, I honestly don't know. All of these things, there's one scenario where all these conflicts lead to lots of peace breaking out and the pendulum swings again and we rebuild and we re-energize and we reorganize or not. And we're in World War III. And I honestly, it depends on the day of the week that which of those scenarios is prevalent in my mind.
Right. And I guess we are seeing increasing extremes, longer term droughts and in more intense flooding and stuff. So that could amplify some of these issues in different regions. But hopefully we're learning. And of course, we're really not talking face to face as much as we ever did. So I think we're going to be missing out on that also, because I often think it's hard for somebody to be angry with me if I'm facing them and trying. And so I try to have face to face meetings a lot of times to learn more and to create an environment where you can discuss things more reasonably. So our guest today is Aaron Wolf, and he's a professor at Oregon State University, and he works on transboundary water resources with a fairly unique background, including environmental science and conflict resolution. Thank you so much, Aaron, for your time today. I really appreciate it, and hope you keep doing what you're doing and helping us understand these issues.
Well, thanks to you, Bridget, for all you add to the water world. Much appreciated.